One question that I am asked very often is, how have you handled your bitterness or anger against God, given some of the events of your life? And the question always surprises me, if not shocks me, really, because to me, there's a very, very simple answer. It's not necessarily an easy answer. I don't mean that. It's not, for me, a pat answer, but it's a very simple answer. I can't imagine being bitter against the one who made me and the one who loves me and the one who is in charge of my life. And quite apart from the fact that he made me and I had no choice about that, and he loves me and I had nothing to do with that, there was a time many, many years ago when I asked the Lord to be my Lord. And to be my Lord means to be master, to be in charge. And he is that. He's my Lord. And therefore, I am at his orders. He's not at mine. And he can do anything he wants with me. I certainly don't expect to treat God as some kind of a talisman. He's my refuge. I can't dictate to him what the terms are. He dictates to me, and I trust him because I love him. But it comes down, doesn't it, to the very basic question of authority. Who is running this show? And that's what I'd like to talk to you about this afternoon, the question of authority. I think the reason that our country seems to be in such a mess is the breakdown of authority. And the more we decide to do our own thing and let everybody else do his own thing and call that freedom, the more we create for ourselves bitter new kinds of bondage. And it starts in the home long before the child goes to school, and it's perpetuated in school. If we give a child his own way, if we are not disciplined ourselves as parents, obviously we can't discipline children, and if they've never been disciplined at home, they can hardly expect the teachers in school to do everything that the parents have not been able to do at home. So, one illustration which I find amusing and delightful comes from the British comedienne Joyce Grenfell. So it is with my apologies to her that I give you just a few lines of her nursery school routine. Children, pay attention, please. Everybody turn round this way, please. We've got a lovely surprise for you this morning. We've got a visitor. Isn't that nice? Yes, it is, Sydney. And what do we say to our visitor? We say, good morning, visitor. No, Peggy, our visitor hasn't got a funny hat on. That's her hair. I'm so sorry, Mrs. Hingle. I'm afraid we're a trifle outspoken sometimes. You find us having a free activity period this morning, and in our free activity period, each little individual can choose his or her own form of occupation. Get out from under the table there, please, Sydney, and find something to do. We feel that each little individual has got to get to the bottom of himself and learn what he wants from life. Who is making that buzzing noise? Well, stop it, please, Neville. Yes, I know you're a little busy bee, but I don't like to hear you buzzing. No, not even very quietly. I can still hear you, Neville. Neville. Who's making... George, don't do that. Sydney, stop blowing at Edgar. Yes, I know I said you could choose what you're going to do, but you cannot choose to blow at Edgar. Well, because I don't think it's a good idea. Well, because I'm not going to discuss it with you, Sydney. Etc. I haven't got time to give you the whole thing. But you get the picture. A free activity period. And the moment each little individual begins to do his or her own form of occupation, there's trouble. Because my liberty ends on the end of your nose, doesn't it? And Sydney's liberty to blow at Edgar was taken exception to by the teacher. And of course, the child is up against authority at home, if he comes from the right kind of a home, and rebels against that authority. Any mother of an infant of as little as 6 weeks knows that there is in that child already rebellion. And that's what it means to be sinful and human, doesn't it? We are determined that nobody is going to tell us what to do. Nobody is going to build any fences beyond which we cannot go. And the child is then, of course, up against authority again when he goes to school. Who is this person, this teacher or this mother or this father, that places these very odious restrictions upon us? I have a good friend in Tucson, a woman by the name of Barb Tompkins, who has three beautifully behaved little children. And I've had some very enlightening conversations with Barb about how she does it. And just a few weeks ago, my husband and I had breakfast with Barb and her two-and-a-half-year-old daughter, Katie. And Barb had very wisely brought along some toys and things to amuse Katie at the breakfast, but we were impressed with how beautifully behaved the child was. But there were a few points of testing. And at one point, we had been discussing, at my insistent questioning of Barbara, how she went about training her children, and she said that before the children were born, she read the book called Happiness is a Choice, and she decided to teach her children to make choices, how to make wise choices, which would lead to happiness. And so during the breakfast, at one point, little Katie took her mother's purse and opened it up and took out of it a pen. And Barbara, in a very natural and unprovoked tone of voice, turned to her and said, "Katie, that is not a choice." And she took the pen away and she said, "But these are." And she offered her several other things from the purse. And so Katie was allowed to choose one of those. And her mother said, "That's an excellent choice, Katie." And then when Katie decided she was going to string beads, her mother said, "Now, what color would you like to start with?" And Katie picked a red bead. And her mother said, "That's an excellent choice, Katie." And so Katie began to string the beads. And then she interrupted at one point, and her mother turned to her and said, she said, "Katie, you are not in charge. But would you like to be in charge of Baby Flo?" Baby Flo being a little doll that she had on the table. So Katie was given to understand that she was not in charge of the adult conversation, but she could be in charge of something. And her mother, as I questioned her further, I said, "Did you have any major crises?" And she said, "Well, I'm sure there were several before this," but she said, "When Katie was 18 months old, I decided it was time that I had to teach her to keep within the boundaries of the yard. They had no fence, but they live in the desert on the outskirts of Tucson, and there are rattlesnakes and Gila monsters and things, and it was for Katie's own good, as well as her mother's peace of mind, that she learned to stay in the yard." And so she said, "I set aside a day to do this," which may seem like a tremendously great sacrifice for a young mother to set aside a day, but she knew, of course, that it would be for Katie's salvation and for her own saving of time later. Obviously, far more time than a day would be saved if Katie learned this lesson of obedience in one day. And so they went outside, and Barbara took Katie around the boundaries of the property and explained to her, "This is as far as our yard goes, and that's not our yard. You stay in our yard. If you go over this line, you are choosing a spanking." And so Barb sat down in her lawn chair with her magazine and said, "Katie, you may play." And so Katie played for maybe 3 or 4 minutes, and then she was very quickly testing the line. And her mother watched until she, of course, stepped over the line. Whereupon, again, without anger, her mother called and she said, "Katie, would you come here, please?" Well, of course, this lesson had been learned long before Katie was 18 months old, that when Mama says come, she came. And Barb said, "Katie, I see that you have chosen a spanking." And she talks always in a normal tone of voice, no baby talk, no raising of her voice or anything. And so without any further ado, she administered the spanking. And then she did what she says she always does, took Katie on her lap, hugged her, told her she loved her, and told her some good things that Katie had done that day, reminded her of how pleased she was because of the way she ate her breakfast or something like that. And then she went around the boundaries again and explained. Now remember, when you step over this line, you are choosing a spanking. It didn't take all day. The lesson was learned. Katie recognized authority. She knew that her mother loved her. And to me, that's the basic issue when it comes to my submission to God. It's not that he's a long-bearded, beetle-browed person who sits up there, and as Paul Little used to put it, he's not watching for somebody that's having fun so that he can say, "Cut it out!" You know, he loves us. And what he wants is our freedom and our peace and our joy. And so authority is based, first of all, on who God is, on the character of God. Does he love me? Does he have my best interests at heart? Obviously, the one who makes something wants that thing to be used for precisely the thing for which it was designed and to be used successfully. And God is the one who designed us. It stands to reason that he wants us to be all that he meant us to be. And if we are, that can't help but lead to fulfillment and freedom. I want to read very quickly some verses from Numbers 11, Deuteronomy 1, and 8. There was a mixed company of strangers who joined the Israelites. These people began to be greedy for better things. And the Israelites themselves wept once again and cried, "Will no one give us meat?" I can just imagine this mixed company of strangers moving in there and saying, "Well, what do you eat out here in this waste, howling wilderness?" "Well, this is what we eat, this stuff." "Well, what in the world is that?" "Well, manna." "Well, what else do you eat?" "Well, nothing." "You mean that's all? That stuff? Day in and day out, three times a day?" "Yes." So they began to weep and cry and be greedy for better things and say, "Will no one give us meat? Think of it. In Egypt we had fish for the asking, cucumbers and watermelons, leeks and onions and garlic. Now our throats are parched. There's nothing wherever we look except this manna." This stuff that God has limited us to. It says here, it tasted like looked like coriander seed, the color of gum resin. People went about collecting it, ground it up in hand mills or pounded it in mortars, then boiled it in the pot and made it into cakes. It tasted like butter cakes. Sounds good to me. When dew fell on the camp at night, the manna fell with it. Moses heard the people wailing, all of them and their families, at the opening of their tents. Can't you just get the picture? Forgotten how many hundreds of thousands of tents there must have been, but can't you just see every family standing at the door of his tent, wailing and moaning and groaning and complaining? And I'm sure that the little kids wouldn't have thought of moaning if their parents hadn't, because there are thousands of societies where the food has been basically one thing. Lots of millions of people have lived on rice, and I know that the jungle Indians live mainly on manioc, and it wouldn't occur to a child to complain about the rice or the manioc. That's it. When you talk about food, you're talking about manioc. But here they were. So the Lord became very angry, and Moses was troubled. He said to the Lord, "Why hast thou brought trouble on thy servant? How have I displeased the Lord that I am burdened with the care of this whole people? Am I their mother? Have I brought them into the world, and am I called upon to carry them in my bosom like a nurse with her babies to the land promised by thee on oath to their fathers? Where am I to find meat to give them all? They pester me with their wailing, and their give us meat to eat. This whole people is a burden too heavy for me. I cannot carry it alone. If that is thy purpose for me, then kill me outright." Moses had really had it up to here with those people. Well, that's not the end of the story. In Deuteronomy 1, he reviews the story of their rebellion about another matter. God had told them to move into the country of the Amorites. And it wasn't enough that God had told them that it would be a good place for them to go. No, they had to wait and send in spies to find out whether or not God was really telling the truth. And the spies came back with a very good report and with samples of the luscious fruit that they had found in the gorge of Eshcol. And they said, they made their report, it is a rich land that the Lord our God is giving us. You'd think that ought to be sufficient evidence. But Moses says, you refused to go up and rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. You muttered treason in your tents, and you said it was because the Lord hated us that he brought us out of Egypt. Mind you, they were slaves in Egypt. They suffered, and here they are, freed from slavery and complaining that it's because God hates them that he brought them out of Egypt to hand us over to the Amorites to be wiped out. What should we find up there? Our kinsmen have discouraged us by their report of a people bigger and taller than we are and of great cities with fortifications towering to the sky. And they told us they saw there the descendants of the Anakim, who were giants, of course. So Moses said, you must not dread them nor be afraid of them. The Lord your God who goes at your head will fight for you, and he will do again what you saw him do for you in Egypt and in the wilderness. You saw there how the Lord your God carried you all the way to this place as a father carries his son. In spite of this, you did not trust the Lord your God, who went ahead on the journey to find a place for your camp. He went in fire by night to show you the way you should take, and in a cloud by day. And you remember that because of the complaints, God swore that they would never reach the promised land. And they died in the wilderness. They wandered for many more years than they would have had to if they had followed God's directions. And then they died. And in Deuteronomy 8, you must remember all that road by which the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, to humble you, to test you, and to discover whether or no it was in your heart to keep his commandments. He humbled you and made you hungry. Then he fed you on manna, which neither you nor your fathers had known before, to teach you that man cannot live on bread alone, but lives by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Take this lesson to heart, that the Lord your God was disciplining you as a father disciplines his son. For the Lord your God is bringing you to a rich land, a land of streams, of springs, and underground waters, gushing out in hill and valley, a land of wheat and barley, of vines, fig trees, pomegranates, a land of olives, oil, and honey. It is a land where you will never live in poverty nor want for anything, a land whose stones are iron ore, and from whose hills you will dig copper. He repeats this again. He led you to humble you and test you, and in the end, to make you prosper. Now that's the story of what God wants to do with every single person who will obey him, who will believe that he really means what he says. The whole wonderful history of Israel, wonderful and depressing, terribly depressing in spots, and we are so tempted to say, how in the world could they have acted like that? Until we take a look in the mirror and we realize that this is precisely the way we act. And the very fact that so many Christians can ask me the question, how did you handle your anger against God? All I can say is these things. A bane of my existence. I really don't believe that I've ever doubted that God loved me. Mind you, there has been plenty of disobedience and plenty of reluctance and hesitation and plenty of sin. But deep down in my heart, there is no question in my mind that God does love me, and that whatever he allows to happen, it's for this very reason that he gave to the children of Israel. To humble me, to test me, and to find out whether or not I really am going to be obedient. What is in my heart? Fortunately, I had a father who disciplined us as sons and daughters. I had a mother who did the same thing. If my mother was home, she was in charge. If my father was home, he was in charge. But we knew that the word they spoke was exactly what they meant. There was consistency. There was self-discipline on the part of the parents. We saw that they never required anything of us that they didn't require of themselves first. And there was love. We knew that they loved us. There was very little physical love. There certainly wasn't any of this touchy-poo stuff that's so popular nowadays. But in other ways, hesitant, let's say, even reticent, shy, New England ways. My father showed us that he loved us. He was a New Englander from way back. And my mother was rather a rigid, straight-laced Philadelphian, went to a Quaker school. But there wasn't any question in our minds that the decisions that they made and the things that they required of us were for our own good. They disciplined us, and God disciplines me as a father disciplines his son, in order to know what's in my heart and in order to take me into that rich land. There's no way that God could have ever taken them into the land of Canaan without first liberating them from the slavery of Egypt. And in order to get rid of the bonds, they also had to get rid of the leeks and the onions and the garlic and the watermelons and the cucumbers and the fish. Now, there's nothing wrong with any of those things, is there? I think this is one of the places where we make a lot of mistakes. We can't imagine why God has to take away a perfectly good thing. Well, for the simple reason, and it's very simple, it's right here, that he has a better thing. There are a lot of good things in the world, there are a lot of better things in the world, and there are some best things. Cucumbers and garlic and fish and onions and leeks are gifts of God. Not one thing wrong with them, nothing immoral about them. But they had to go out into that wilderness and be hungry. Get so hungry that they would eat this heavenly food called manna, which they would have scorned if they had had a choice. They got to the point where God gave them just this one choice. It's you eat this or you die. And so for a while they ate the manna until this mixed company of strangers came along and stirred them up, got them all churned up into rebellion, which is, of course, what the world is always doing to us. You mean this is what you Christians are stuck with? You Christians are so hung up, you can't do your own thing, you're always trying to do somebody else's thing? Forget it. No, let it all hang out. Do your thing. Express your anger. Tell everybody exactly what you think about them. You owe it to yourself. You ever heard that kind of nonsense? And so, of course, they got churned up and they complained. And their complaints were the death of them. They died in the wilderness. It was when I was 10 years old that I made a public profession of faith. I asked Jesus to be my Savior. I think I had probably done it years before that, but I don't have a date in my mind. I don't remember an earlier experience, but I do very vividly remember the experience when I was 10 years old. I wanted to make sure that I was born again. But it was when I was 12 that it dawned on me that Jesus can't be my Savior unless he's also my Lord. And I prayed then that he would be Lord of my life. That was a choice. God will not invade your will. He created you with the freedom to choose to love him. That's what God wanted. He created all the rest of the universe, with the exception, as far as we know, of the heavenly beings like cherubim and seraphim and angels, and us human beings who were created to love him by choice. Clams and Scotty dogs and bighorn sheep are created to glorify God, and they do so perfectly all the time. They are sinless creatures. They were never given a free will. But God wanted a creature who was free to love him. And the only way that we could possibly be free to love him was to be free not to love him. And so he has given us that choice. And he will not retract that gift. Jesus offers us the choice of life and death. Come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. He is not going to drop it in your lap. You have to come. You have to ask. How many times when Jesus healed people did he say, what do you want me to do? He knew what was wrong with the person, but he wanted that person to acknowledge his need, to state it, and to come to him who had the power to meet that need. And so he gave me the choice, and I chose life. I said, Lord, I want you to be Lord of my life. And I did it because I trusted him. I really believed he meant what he said. I loved him because he had loved me first. He loved me and gave himself for me. And it was an irrevocable commitment. I've never, as far as I know, even been tempted. Maybe my memory is poor, but I really cannot remember ever being tempted to renege on that commitment. I have not always liked what God did. You can be sure. There have been a lot of things that have happened in my life that have been very far from my own blueprint of the way I thought things ought to work out. Very far from what I expected God to do. And I wrote a novel about that one time, about another woman who had different kinds of experiences, but exactly the same lesson, which I have had to learn again and again and again. I am the Lord. I died. I am alive. I have the keys. That's what he said to John on the island of Patmos, remember? And John says that that hand that held the seven stars was laid on me. And the voice that was like the sound of a waterfall said, don't be afraid. He's a sovereign God. And I say to you this afternoon that I know no truth in all the universe. That is so fortifying and so stabilizing as the doctrine of the sovereignty of God. It simply means he's in charge. He's got the whole world in his hands. And absolutely nothing can ever touch me or anybody I love for which he has not already made provision and for which he does not give permission. Why does he give permission? There's far more to the answer than you and I will know until we see him. But it seems to me we have all the answer we need right here. He took us through that waste howling wilderness to humble us, to test us. God has proved to me again and again that I can't make it on my own. That's humbling. I know that I cannot do what God wants me to do by myself. What am I going to do with this? I know that he is my refuge and strength. He is my stronghold. The Lord is my light and my salvation. How could I ever learn that if I'd never been in darkness? How could I ever need a savior if I didn't know that I was drowning? How could I need a stronghold if I didn't know that I was weak? He has done what he's done in my life for the same reason that he did what he did to the Israelites, to humble them, to test them, to know what was in their hearts, and to let us be hungry in order that he can feed us with heavenly food. I was talking to my mother the other day. She's 84 years old. She gets great waves of nostalgia and loneliness. And I was trying to just remind her of some of these things that there's nothing I know that she didn't know long before I did. But we all need to be reminded, don't we? And as C.S. Lewis said to his closest friend, Arthur Greaves, we can paddle every canoe except our own. You know, I can go all over the country and just dish out this stuff, but I need to have somebody say it to me because I can't paddle my canoe.
And so I thought maybe it will help to say it to my mother. And just to remind her that this very loneliness is a hunger that God lets her have because he's about to give her some nectar, you know, some of the foods of the gods. She can't possibly have very many more years in this world, maybe 10. I'd be surprised if she lasted that long. But it's in order to wean her away from all of the things that make her feel so nostalgic, in order to set her sights on the land, the rich land that he's taking her to. And that's what he's trying to do with all of us. We don't have to be 84 years old before God gives us those lessons. And he starts in very early. In fact, I was just rereading Jim Elliot's love letters recently in the process of writing a book, which I'm just now finishing up, on the subject of passion and purity. And at the age of 25, Jim was quoting to me that old hymn, the title of the hymn, I think, is We Would Seek Jesus. And the last stanza says, the blessings of our pilgrimage are failing. We would not mourn them, for we go to thee. Jim couldn't imagine that he only had 3 years left when he wrote that. But that's the way he lived. He was all there. Wherever God wanted him to be, he was all there. He lived to the hilt. And that's the way I want to do, whatever the stage of my journey, whether it's the place where all he's going to give me is manna, or whether it's Marah, where the water is bitter, or whether it's at the point where the meat came, or the places where they got water out of the rock, whatever the stage of the journey, I want to remember that he is my Lord, and that he took me out of Egypt in order to take me into a rich land. I may not like the route. And it certainly looks like a very circuitous route. It was, geographically speaking, a very circuitous route for Israel. But he had to take them through the wilderness in order to teach them these lessons. The Lord your God is bringing you into a rich land. I don't know anybody in this room. I don't know what your personal crises may be. I don't know the way in which God may be allowing you to be hungry. I can't say I know exactly what you're going through. But I can say this for sure. I know the one who knows. And I know that he has never once failed me. When Jesus said to the disciples, when I sent you out without purse, without shoes, lacked ye anything? And they said nothing. You will never lack anything that you really need. I saw a beautiful article in the Christian Herald magazine about a couple who have adopted 32 children. No, excuse me, they have 8 of their own children, and they have adopted 24 more. And they call themselves the family that doesn't need anything. The father is a superintendent of buildings and grounds for public schools. So you can imagine that he doesn't make a tremendous salary. But the mother said, we don't need anything because we know that if there's something we need, God's going to give it to us. If there's something we want that we don't have, we don't need it. And I believe that's true of every child of God. Aren't you of more value than many sparrows? Your Heavenly Father feeds them. Take care not to forget the Lord your God, and do not fail to keep his commandments, laws, and statutes, which I give you this day. When you have plenty to eat and live in fine houses of your own building, when your herds and flocks increase, and your silver and gold and all your possessions increase too, do not become proud and forget the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. He led you through the vast and terrible wilderness infested with poisonous snakes and scorpions, a thirsty, waterless land where he caused water to flow from the hard rock. He fed you in the wilderness on manna which your fathers did not know, to humble you, to test you, and in the end, to make you prosper. Who is it that's in charge of your life? Does he have all the authority? Or are you trying to negotiate? As a girl said to me, I'll tell the Lord that I'll go to the mission field if he'll give me a husband. And I said, well, who are we to be specifying the terms of our obedience? He's not Lord at all unless he is Lord of all. The great Scottish preacher, I believe it was Graham Scroggie, who spoke to a young girl who was struggling with her will against God's. And he gave her a little piece of paper, and he wrote on the paper, "Yes, Lord." And he said, "Now I want you to go over there and sit down quietly by yourself for 10 minutes and bring me this card back with one of those two words crossed out." And so she came back, and he said, "If it's yes to your will, to what you want to do, then it can't be Lord. Which do you want?" And so she, of course, crossed out the yes that she was going to do, the determination to do her own will. I would ask you if you believe that God is worth trusting. You can't submit to an authority willingly unless that authority is worth trusting. Is it worth the price that it will cost you? Because be sure you are going to have to go through a wilderness at some point. Jesus said you will get into heaven only through much tribulation. Not a bed of roses. Where is it that God is taking you? Is that where you want to go? Or would you rather do your own thing? Is there a purpose in the very thing that God is dealing with you about this afternoon? You can be sure there is, but it's a loving purpose. Everything that happens fits into a pattern for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to his purpose. And his purpose is that we should be conformed to the image of his Son. Only God knows what it takes to conform Elizabeth Gren into the image of his Son. It's a very long process. It's going to take a lot of the hammer and the chisel and the fire to do that. And I know he has a long way to go. But I know that the final product that he has in mind will be perfection and fulfillment for me and, incidentally, happiness. You know, there really isn't any other route to happiness. Happiness is a byproduct of obedience. Don't aim for happiness. Aim for obedience, and you'll be happy. If you aim for happiness, you're going to be disobedient. The authority of Jesus Christ, the sovereignty of God, never lose sight of those two facts. I'd like to close with words from that marvelous old saint, Samuel Rutherford of Scotland, in the 17th century. "It is impossible to be submissive and religiously patient if ye stay your thoughts down among the confused rollings and wheels of second causes, such as, oh, the place, oh, the time, oh, if this had not been, that had followed, oh, the linking of this accident with this time and place. Look up to the master motion and the first wheel." God bless you.